Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Musings on Golf. For today, you'll hear great storytelling from two-time Masters champion Bernhard Langer. We'll also revisit a terrific putting performance that Scottie Scheffler put on display last week and look ahead to his title defense this week at the 50th edition of the Players' Championship. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my good friend and co-host Bob Bupka. Hey, Bob, you know, our listeners certainly enjoyed the stellar play of Mr. Scheffler at the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard. And man, are they going to love hearing from Mr. Bernhard Langer.
He's just one of the best, not only on the golf course, he's proven that, won more times on the PGA Tour Champions than anybody else. It was Hale Irwin that had that record at 45, and people said that'll never be broken. Langer had different ideas about that. And he's not only delightful as a golfer, he's even more delightful, Kelly, as we witnessed during the interview, as a gentleman.
Yeah, and you've seen that over the years, right, Bob? And covering him, the way he conducts himself. I agree, as classy an individual. You know, I was lucky to sit next to some the best players in the world during my time at the PGA of America. No question. Tiger, Phil, Rory, et cetera. None are classier, in my opinion, than Bernhard Langer. What is it about him that really stands out to you?
Well, his faith. His faith is what motivates him. His faith is what inspires him. He's a great family man. I mean, you take a great family man that's heavily involved in his faith, you automatically have a great individual. And I think our listeners, our musings, going to find out things about Bernhard Langer that they're going to be surprised about. Just a class A act, and we're so proud to have him as a guest on our show.
Yeah, and what set us apart from the start, Bob, is great storytelling. That's why Musings on Golf exists, and this interview is fantastic. You're going to hear from him in a bit, even with him having torn his Achilles playing pickleball back in February at age 66. Sounds like he's raring to go come May. Speaking of raring to go, a big shift in putters for Scottie Scheffler, world number one player, made the decision after really being with a blade putter for a long time to go with a tailor-made mallet putter. Did it ever pay off? What performance, Bob. Wins by 5 at the Arnold Palmer Invitational over Wyndham Clark. You know, he hadn't won in a year since winning at the Players last year. Talk about what you saw from him that enabled him to get back on the victory stand.
Well, I'm unlike most people. What I saw was a putting stroke. I could have taken any putter and put it in his hand and put that stroke on it, and he would have been successful. You know, it's never the arrow. It's always the Indian. I've watched 2 or 3 highly touted, I mean highly touted, putting instructors working their trade while on the putting green. Most of the conversations often went a little like this. A player that would be putting takes a putt and it misses. And the coach says, no, didn't quite like that stroke. He takes another one, it misses. No, don't like that stroke. Third one, it goes in. The coach says, yeah, that's it. That's the stroke. I mean, good golly, put the right stroke on with any putter. The putter's not going to decide, hey, I'm a good putter or I'm a bad putter. I mean, the club itself, I mean, it only reacts to the reaction of the players. So I think a little too much is made of different putters and probably get scolded by putter manufacturers because they love the fact that somebody's trying to a new one all the time. Look how many you've tried and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, and I don't know that it'll ever work with my stroke, to tell you the truth. But look, the game's always been there. He's been the world number one, as we mentioned. I thought the quote from Rory McIlroy was really interesting. Rory said within the last week, he said, quote, his ball striking, honestly, is on another level compared to everyone else right now. We knew if he started to hole putts, then this sort of stuff would happen. And in fact, at the Genesis Invitational at LA at Riviera, Bob, Rory had mentioned about the fact that he had changed to a mallet putter and had a lot of success with it. And then Scheffler goes to this TaylorMade Spyder Tour X mallet. He led the field in putting on Sunday. was fifth overall for the week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. And boy, was he ever happy to get the victory.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he's probably sick and tired. He's been the number one golfer in the world. And all he hears about is, what about your putting, Scotty? What about that putter? It's so now he can put that to rest. He goes to the Players' Championship, not only being the hottest golfer on the planet, but now the best putter on the planet. Boy, that's a lethal combination.
Sure is. Let's hear what Mr. Scheffler had to say on his victory in Orlando.
Really special. You know, Mr. Palmer meant a lot to me, meant a lot to us as professional golfers and the game of golf. And so it's very special to be able to, you know, wear his red sweater again. And yeah, I'm very proud to be the champion in his tournament.
So Bob, he is now going into this week, the 50th Players Championship at the TPC Sawgrass. You know, Bob, you've been around, covered a lot of golf tournaments. This, the stadium golf, it was the vision of Dean Beaman. He certainly brought Pete and Alice Dye along. And they created a golf course really unlike any other. The 17th hole there now, you can argue in a lot of ways on an annual basis, Bob. It's the most famous in golf with the Island Green and so forth. What are your thoughts? You have a good players-related story. What are your thoughts on the evolution of the Players' Championship over the years?
It's more of a mystery to me than any other because I can't come to grips with the fact that nobody's ever been able to successfully defend their title there.
I mean,
that is so strange. I mean, 50 years, nobody's ever to go back to back. I mean, come on. So maybe we'll see it this year. At least Scotty Scheffler's got a good chance of accomplishing that mountain.
So Scheffler goes back to defend. And in the booth, we're going to see some and hear some familiar faces and voices. Roger Maltby and Gary Koch, who had been let go from NBC Sports in the fall of 2022, have been asked to come back for what sounds like Thursday and Friday in their coverage of the Players' Championship. And then our buddy Kevin Kisner, who had joined us. Kis looks like he's the front runner as the analyst for NBC Sports to take over for Paul Azinger. He did a great job earlier this season. He's 0-3, Bob, on his starts on the PGA Tour. I get the sense Kevin Kisner is the guy that NBC Sports is looking to sit next to Dan Hicks for some time.
Well, that'd be a big break for Kevin Kisner. A lot of guys in the running. I love Kevin. He's been great, but you know, Brad Faxon, I don't see any deficiencies in his efforts whatsoever. So
I agree with you. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but certainly going to be great to have Roger Maltby, Gary Koch back in the booth, back on television. Boy, those two guys do it like nobody else. Roger is just a wealth of information, a wealth of personality, and knows how to relate to the average TV fan, and that's a very special trait.
Gary Koch's most famous quip, better than most, on Tiger's lengthy, incredible putt on 17 a number of years ago, certainly is one that everybody can almost recall. I can hear him saying that. But yeah, like you said, about particularly Roger Maltby, Bob, when you're out there, man, and you're walking that golf course, you better be prepared at all times. He brought it every time he was out there. Knowledge, understanding, and a quick explanation to the viewer as to what was going on and what he thought was going to happen next.
Absolutely. He set the standard. If you want to be a color analyst covering golf, let your idol be Roger Maltby. If you can get anywhere near his performance level, he'll have a job for a lifetime.
Okay, before we get to Bernhard Langer, they've got the players coming up, and then we're getting closer and closer to the Masters. So, Bob, I see where the gentlemen and the ladies at Augusta National Golf Club are unveiling the Masters map and flag premium hospitality venue. Weekly passes, and this includes the credentials to get in, $17,000 each. And again, I want to thank you and Janice for that contribution to the Kelly Elbin Fund to enable me to enjoy the 2024 Masters. Map and flag name is derived from the Augusta National's iconic logo. One more way for Augusta National to make the Masters even more special, huh?
Well, I guarantee you there are thousands of people all over the golf world. That, you know, 17,000 may sound sounds a lot of money to me, but of course not to you, and certainly not Miss Susie. $17,000. What do you get for that? You get a ticket every day. You get fine dining. I'm not talking about a hot dog or a pimento cheese sandwich. They got a grill in there with steaks and everything, and hospitality, a place to rest whenever you want. It may sound high, that initial price, $17,000, I think, is a real bargain, and the masses wouldn't do it if they didn't realize that it was a good thing for their patrons.
And they'll do it right. As you know, they always do.
They don't know any other way.
They really don't, do they?
They don't know any other way.
You saw that with what had been a Quonset hut for a media center for years turned into a palatial estate for media, right?
And quite frankly, the Quonset hut worked very well. The sound of those typewriters clicking, they were reverberate off the walls of that Quonset hut. Oh, I love that sound. I miss that sound, and I miss the sound of spikes being on cement.
I don't know about that last part, because being a guy who was with Soft Spikes Incorporated for a long time, we can have a separate debate about that. But I will tell you this, the guy who's going to miss teeing it up next week at the Masters is Bernhard Langer, because of this Achilles tear. He's not going to be able to play in what he had hoped would be his final Masters. My sense is that he'll push it back to next year. But these stories are great. You're going to enjoy them very much. Right after this, from our good friends at William and Harry, looking forward to having you here from Bernhard Langer. Introducing the epitome of golfing elegance and performance from William & Harry. Immerse yourself in style and unparalleled comfort as you step onto the green with William & Harry's unique durable deerskin and calfskin masterpiece. Unrivaled in its water-resistant design, the WH shoe, which is also available in private label, ensures that you stay focused on your swing even in unpredictable weather conditions. Elevate your game to where luxury meets peak performance. Step into excellence. Step into innovation at williamandharry.com.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, as we begin our countdown to the 2024 Masters, we're delighted to welcome in a man who twice has had that coveted green jacket draped over his shoulders in victory. He is also golf's Iron Man, having won more titles on the PGA Tour Champions than anyone else. It appears at age 66, about the only thing that can slow him down is, of all things, pickleball. Bernhard Langer, Bernhard Langer, welcome to Musings on Golf. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, Bernhard, speaking of the Masters and your victories, I want to take you back to an incident that really sticks out in my mind. You may not even remember it, but it was one of the pre-Masters interviews, and the reporter, his name doesn't even matter. I don't even remember who it was, but he was struggling mightily to ask you about your putting problems, but he didn't want to offend you. And he was hemming and hawing. And finally, Charlie Yates said, "Let's just cut to the chase, Bernhard. Do you have the yips? Do you remember?"
I do, yeah. I've had the yips 4 times in my career, so it's been a big part of me. And there've been numerous instances where, you know, that was the main topic. And it was pretty obvious that I had the yips.
Oh, you handled it like a true gentleman that you really are. Matter of fact, I refer to you as a gem of a human being.
Oh, thank you.
You announced this year that this would be your final Masters, and then pickleball came along, and now you announce you're not going to be playing. Can you tell us what happened and the prognosis for your recovery?
Absolutely. I play all sorts of sports to stay fit, and this was part of my fitness regime. And I was playing pickleball here in Woodfield, where I live, and had a lot of fun. And then it just somebody was trying to lob me, and I did a few steps backwards and hit an overhead. And as I landed on the ground with my feet, I heard this huge pop, very loud, like a gunshot. And I knew right away that it was a torn Achilles, because I had seen it happen to other people playing basketball and other sports. And I was very fortunate to have had a doctor at hand who was the head surgeon for foot and ankles in New York in a hospital for over 30 years. So he guided me through the whole process, said, okay, you need an MRI, then you need a boot to keep your foot, you know, safe. And then we got to find a surgeon, and on and on. So it was, that was a miracle to have Dr. Michael Tooman right by me and guide me through that whole process. And since I had surgery 24 hours later after the injury, I started rehab 3 days after surgery, and been in the fitness center by myself doing stuff for the upper body and rehabbing my left leg the last 4 weeks. Things are looking up very good. I'm feeling great. I'm making progress. Actually, yesterday was the first time I could walk around without crutches, without a scooter, on my own, without holding on to anything, which was very exciting. So the prognosis is, yes, I will not play the Masters, but I plan on being there, attend the Champions Dinner on Tuesday, and just enjoy the tournament, hang out with some of my sponsors like Mercedes-Benz and Rolex, and be with family and friends who will attend the tournament as well. My first tournament back was hopefully gonna be the Insperity Invitational in Houston. That's about 3 weeks after the Masters, or four. If that for some reason doesn't happen, then shortly after that.
Oh, please let that happen, because you know I'm going to be there bugging you as usual. Let me ask you this, Bernhard. Have you had any other serious injury besides mental, besides this Achilles heel?
Yeah, I've had a very serious back injury when I was 19 in the Air Force in the boot camp. I had a stress fracture in my lower back and bulging disc. Then I had some surgery in 2011 that took me out about 8 months, where I couldn't play at all or play with a lot of pain. And then we had COVID. That was about a 4 month break or five. And now we have this. So I haven't been injury free, but I'm still very blessed.
One other thing, Bernhard, I've been dying to ask you this for a long time. If you had your own club, would your rules be stricter than they are at Augusta, or would they be more lenient?
What do you mean? Which rules?
Every rule, from the minute you step on the grounds to the minute you pull out of Magnolia Lane.
Well, I think most of the rules of golf are pretty good, and most of the rules they have at Augusta are pretty good. Some might say it's a bit over the top here and there, but the only rule I would change is that we should be able to drop out of divots, because a divot is made by us, and you shouldn't be penalized when you're in the middle of the fairway and you're in either a divot or a sand-filled divot. You should be able to take a drop and have some grass under your ball. That's my opinion.
And that's a valued opinion. Go ahead, Kelly.
Bernhard, I'm wondering, you referenced the Champions Dinner the Tuesday of Masters Week. What's that dinner meant to you? Do you have a the same seat every year? What's that whole vibe like in that room for those few hours?
Yeah, it's one of the highlights of my year. Always look forward to the Champions Dinner, just because of the aura, the being in the presence of some of the greatest players that ever played the game, and together with the chairman. So it's only past champions and the chairman to spend, you know, 2 or 3 hours with these guys in a very intimate setting is very unique. Obviously, the great food and the good wine and all that doesn't hurt either. But
right.
But all, you know, also the stories that some of the guys tell from long time ago, or even just from the last few months, you just learn things about people and the game of golf that I didn't know. And it's always interesting and great to be a part of. And I usually do sit, in the similar chair or, you know, in the same area. I enjoy sitting next to Larry Mize and Zach Johnson. Not that I wouldn't enjoy anybody else either, but we've become very close friends over the years, and we enjoy having an extra hour or two sitting next to each other, having a wonderful dinner together.
Well, I know faith is very important to you, and certainly with those gentlemen, that's a special time. We're thrilled to be joined by two-time Masters champion Bernhard Langer here on Music Zone Golf. He's also one of just 5 golfers who have won professional events on all 6 continents where golf is played. But Bernhard, it had to start somewhere. Please give us a sense why a young man in West Germany in the 60s developed an interest in golf. I assume you played other sports. Why golf?
That's a great question. And I played soccer like any boy in Germany would. I played ping pong and just anything else, you know, hockey. Whatever I could get my hands on and was available, cross-country skiing and skiing and all that kind of stuff. But golf, really, because I come from a poor background, and I saw my older brother, he went to caddy at a local, we had a 9-hole golf course about 5 miles away. So he was able to ride his bicycle there. And when he came home, he earned some Deutschmarks from caddying, and I was 5 years younger. I was 9, and I'm going, man, that's cool to earn some money. So can I do that? And it initially said, no, you're too young, you're too little. And I just bucked him. And a few weeks later, I was on my bike heading to the golf course, trying to earn money. And the very first bag I got was the club champion. And he took a liking to me. He liked this 9-year-old little blonde fellow. And we just hit it off. And he said, from now on, if it's okay with you, you're going to be my regular caddy. Whenever I show up, it doesn't matter who's in front of you in line to be caddying, you're going to be my guy. And I was thrilled. You know, it's much more fun to be caddying for handicap 2 than a handicap 32. So that was my initial, my first few hours, you know, meeting the game of golf. Was really earning money. So I always, when I give my testimony, I always say, I fell in love with golf because I could earn money as a 9-year-old. But it didn't take long that till I fell in love with the game of golf, because we were able to play as caddies when there were no members to caddy for. We had a few clubs that were given to us by members, and we were able to chip and putt and hit balls on the range. And when you got to a certain level, you were even allowed to play on the course. So, you know, in the summertime, when there was no school, we would put our tent next to the golf course. And when the sun came up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, we'd go and play. We had played sometimes 18 holes before a member showed up. And then would caddy for, 18 or 36, and then play another 9 or something like that. So it was just a great way to earn some money and have a good time with some other caddies.
Bernhard, what was the level of interest in golf in general in Germany at that time when you were just starting to get into the game?
There was very minimal. Most people didn't even know what golf was. So we had, let's say, 1966 or 1970, we had probably 100 golf courses in all of Germany. Many of them 9-hole courses, and they were all private clubs. So it was rather expensive. There were no public facilities. And when I, you know, told my friends in school or adults, I said, my goal is to become a professional golfer. They say, what, putt-putt, miniature golf? Well, I'd make a living doing that. You know, that's all they knew. And so it has come a long way. Nowadays, we probably have about 800 courses and close to 1 million golfers in Germany.
Oh, that's fantastic. You said about earning money as a professional. You turned professional in 72. What do you remember about your very first professional victory?
Yeah, it was very unique. I was assistant pro at Munich Country Club, and Jack Nicklaus came. That's a different story. I was playing with him in an exhibition match, but that wasn't my first tournament. My first tournament was same Munich Country Club. There were 25 of the best German teaching pros came to our club, and we had a 36-hole event, and I was able to play in it, and I won it, and I was 15 years old, or 15 and a half, or whatever, and that was a big surprise to anybody, including myself. But I won 500 German marks, which is like $250 at the time, and that was huge. That was like a 2 months income or something like that, you know, so it was a thrill, and maybe that also encouraged me to practice more and pursue playing and, you know, try to make extra money. I was teaching, obviously, for 3.5 years as an assistant pro, and we played a few tournaments, maybe 5 or 6 for the German PGA, and there was a little bit of money, not much, but it was fun getting away and play some events and make a little extra money.
What was the story you were thinking of about Jack and playing with Jack?
Yeah, that was also, I was maybe a year later, I was probably 16 at the time, and Jack Nicklaus came to do an exhibition match at our home club, which is the only one he's done in Germany, I believe. I've given up to this point. And for some reason, they invited me to play with Jack. I still, to this point, don't understand why they picked me, because they invited two of the best German amateurs, and then they chose me. I mean, it could have chosen anybody anyway. So I was so nervous. I had, you know, I was never an amateur, so I didn't have any tournament experience, really. I was caddy and turned pro. And as caddies, we didn't have tournaments and stuff like that. So, and here I'm playing against or with the best golfer in the world. So it was fascinating for me to watch Jack, you know, taking on lines that nobody else. He would cut corners over dog legs and over trees that I had never seen anybody. He was hitting the ball so high and so far. My eyes got this big. It was unbelievable. But the funny story is, or two of them, I shanked an 8-iron, which was very embarrassing, in front of my members and all that. And then on the 5th hole, that used to be a par 5, dogleg left, I hit a good drive, and then I hit 3-iron into the green, and I pulled it left of the green, and it hit a lady on the shoulder and back onto the green. So I went down there, and I felt horrible, and I went to her and said, "Are you okay?" You know, and she said, "Yeah, I'm fine. Just keep playing. Have fun. You know, I'm good." And I made the eagle putt, so that was my highlight of the day. But
talk about a good bounce, huh?
Yeah, very much so. And then later day, when the day was over, they interviewed Jack. The media was there, obviously, and asked, "So what do you think of your 3 play partners?" And, you know, German media. And the Jack said, "Well, the 2 amateurs showed great, you know, a lot of hope. They have fantastic techniques. They can be really good players. They have a lot of potential." And he kept talking about the 2 amateurs. And then somebody decided, "Well, what about the young pro?" And he goes, "Well, he's got a lot of heart."
This sounds like Jay. Hey, yeah. Bernhard, it's an honor to be joined by you on Musings on Golf. And I want to reach out to the good people at Mercedes and Rolex for assisting us in this interview. What was it like for you seeing Augusta National Golf Club for the first time and playing in your first Masters?
Yeah, that was an incredible experience for me. You know, growing up in Germany, playing the European Tour in the in the mid-70s, I had never seen a golf course like Augusta. So beautifully manicured. There wasn't a blade of grass that wasn't supposed to be there. In the 80s, there was no rough. It was all fairways and then pine needles. And that's another thing. I had never seen a golf course without rough. And then you looked at the greens, and they were just magnificent. I mean, very undulated, really fast. I had never experienced greens like that in my whole life. And sure enough, my first two rounds, I played 36 holes, and I was 11 shots behind the leader. They had the 10-shot rule. And I made 10 3-putts in 36 holes. So I learned my lesson. The next time I was invited back 2 years later, I said, you got to figure out these greens. You got to know greens and where to hit it, where not, and how to putt better. It's a phenomenal place. There's nothing like Augusta. You know, every other major moves around different venues. Augusta is so unique that you always go back to the same course, and they tweaked that course many a times, you know, from planting 5,000 trees to introducing the rough some years back to making it a lot longer now and all sorts of things. And it's the only tournament in the world where they don't have any tents. There's not one building that is temporary. All the buildings at Augusta are permanent structures, which is unheard of.
So is pimento cheese for $1.50. Kind of ironic, Bernhard, that you sharing that first encounter with Jack Nicklaus. And then in 1986, you get to slip the green jacket on Jack Nicklaus on what many argue the best Masters ever played. Jack's sixth win in 1986, winning the Masters. What a special week that was.
Yes, it sure was. I remember a lot of things from that week, and especially I just played a couple of groups ahead of Jack, and I heard these huge roars on the back nine when he made one birdie after another, and I knew something special was happening. And sure enough, you know, Jack wins his sixth Masters, oldest winner of a major at that point in time. And yeah, I got to slip the jacket on him because I had won it the previous year, and that was a special moment because we became friends over the years, and he only lives 30 minutes from where I live here in Florida, and his son caddied for him. So that had to be, you know, one of the major highlights for Jack, just to have his son caddying for him to win at age 46, to win six green jackets and all that kind of stuff. It was quite the week and quite the finish by the Golden Bear.
Yeah, it was quite the week for me too, Bernhard. I had arrangements made to get into the circle with the Pinkenning guards as Jack was being led up to Butler Cabin. So I got to ask the first question after that victory, and that initial interview has led to a lifelong friendship of Jack and Barbara. I put Jack, Barbara, and Bernhard Langer, all of you are cut from the same cloth.
Well, I appreciate you saying this because I think very highly of Jack and Barbara. They're wonderful people. They're giving back and they're doing lots of good, you know, not just a great golfer, but a great person.
Bernhard, the year before, reason you were able to slip that jacket on Jack in 86, you won your first Masters, held off Seve, Raymond, and Curtis Strange. What was that like, particularly that final day? I mean, those were, you know, trying to win your first major, being hunted down by some greats of the game. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was not so much being hunted down. I was the one hunting because Curtis.
No, that's right.
Curtis Strange had a lead, and it was the most extraordinary Masters. I believe he shot 80 the first day, Curtis Strange did, and he packed his suitcase coming to the golf course thinking he's going to miss the cut. And then he went crazy, shot like 65, 66, 67 or something, 3 days, or no, 65, 66 or something like that. And he had a 2-shot lead, I believe, going into Sunday. So from thinking of missing the cut, he was leading. And then the only time I looked at the leaderboard on that Sunday was up to 9 holes earlier in the round. And I think I shot even par on the front 9, which I always thought was the much harder 9 to play. The back 9 in the old days seemed to be easier. So I was hoping to make up ground with even par. And I looked at the leaderboard, and now I'm 4 behind Curtis, starting off 2 behind. Now I'm 4 behind. I'm going, oh my goodness, you know, he's playing great golf. I got to do something really, really special on the back 9 to have any hope of winning this championship. And, you know, I had a very aggressive attitude and went for flags no matter where they were, and got fortunate enough to, I think I birdied 5 of the next 8 holes, if I'm not mistaken. And Curtis went into the water a couple of times. Savvy was continuously trying to close the gap to me, and I'm sure Raymond Floyd. And then the next time I looked at the leaderboard was on 17 green, when I just made birdie, and I saw that I had a 2-shot lead. So I went from 4 behind on the 10th tee to 2 ahead on the 18th tee. And it was a nerve-wracking 18th hole, even though Savvy patted me on the back as we walked off the 17th green. And he patted me on the back and said, hey, this is yours, you know, go get it. And I'm saying, I'm thinking, well, it's not mine yet. I still got a tough hole to play.
Yeah.
Gonna happen.
To say the least.
Yeah, but as it turned out, I won by 2, and that was obviously a dream come true for me. I had been very close to winning the Open Championship a couple of times before that, especially in 1984 at St. Andrews when Savvy won. He beat me by 2. So we had a couple of showdowns, him and myself, over the years, and we miss him dearly.
Yeah, 8 years later at Augusta, you top chip back to win your second, beat him by 4 shots. Anything in particular stand out from that Masters victory?
Yeah, it was very different this time around because I wasn't hunting. I was the one being hunted. I had a 4 shot going into Sunday. And a lot of people think, oh, 4 shots is a huge lead. You should be winning. But we saw what happened to Greg Norman. He had a 5 shot lead, I think.
Yeah.
Or and so I tried to play aggressive conservatively, if you can figure that out. You know, some holes I attacked, some I played just safe. And some other guys were closing the gap. So I stood on the 10th hole and I had a 1-shot lead. And I'm going, okay, this is not working out. You got to make more birdies. You got to be more aggressive. You're not going to win shooting even par. You got to go after it. And played the back 9 again very, very well. And I was watching Dan Forsman in front of me. I was on the 11th screen. He was on the 12th tee, the infamous or famous par 3 aiming call. And I believe he hit 2 in the water. And like he said later in an interview, instead of saying amen, I said, oh, hell, whatever.
Something along those lines, right?
Yeah, some along those lines. So, and he was the closest competitor at the time when I was on the 11th screen. So I figured, well, he must have made a 7 or something, and he was probably out of contention at that point in time. So then, you know, I had Chip Beck and a couple other guys that were still very close. Another thing that stood out to me there was the 2 holes later, the 13th, which is, by the way, my favorite hole at all of Augusta, the dogleg par 5, just after aiming corner. And I hit a beautiful draw off the tee right around the corner, and I had a 3-iron off a hanging lie into a front pin. And I maybe the best golf shot I've hit in my life, and I've hit a ton of them. It just started dead on line with a slight bit of a draw, ended up about 15 feet left of the pin inside of Chip Beck's second shot. So I was able to see what his putt did, how it broke. he made birdie, I made eagle, and that increased my lead when it, you know, looked that it could have decreased because he hit a phenomenal shot in there. And that gave me the confidence to, you know, finish it off, close it off. And I really enjoyed walking up 18 with a 4-shot lead. I knew I could manage that. And just, you know, the standing ovation you get from the patrons, it was
that,
amazing.
What's that feeling like? Yeah, it chills up your back. What's that like?
Oh, yeah, the hair stands up on your neck and on your forearms. And it's just a great feeling to realize you're going to win the Masters again. And, you get to come back here as long as you like and be a part of this phenomenal tournament that has so much history and so many great champions. And you know, and I saw my wife sitting at the back of the green with two of our kids, actually three of our kids at that point in time. And, you know, that meant the world to me to have their support and be there to celebrate with family and friends. There was one other quick story. If we have time, I don't know.
Please.
In 1985, I had won the Australian Masters in March in Melbourne, Australia. And the people who run that, there were two friends that would run the tournament. They always treated themselves to come to the U.S. Masters because they were running the Australian Masters. So they had tickets. They would always go to the... So a month later, I see him at Augusta and they go, oh, we put some money on you to win. And I go, oh, that's, you know, you do whatever you want with your money. But it turned out they were part of a Calcutta and they looked at the odds of the players and they thought I was a good bet because I just won their tournament and I think I finished second or third at the Players Championship like a week before the Masters or 10 days. So they put money on me. Make a long story short, they won more money than I did winning the Masters in 1980. They threw a huge party on Sunday night. They invited my wife and I, and I said, well, I got to go to the dinner with the members first. You know, after you get the drink, but you got to have dinner with the chairman and the members. And I said, when that's over with, I'll come over to join your party at your house. And it was phenomenal. It was great.
Yeah, that party was still going on, wasn't it?
Oh, it went on into the morning hours. It did.
Bernhard, I got to share something personal with you. I've been trying to live my life so that I get to heaven at the end of it by living the life the Lord would like me to live. And I just want to know that I'm practicing with you because I know heaven is full of Bernhard Langers. I thank you for the friendship. I thank you for the working relationship. And I thank you on behalf of golfers everywhere, of not only one of the finest golfers that ever played the game, certainly one of the truest gentlemen. And Kelly, I know you want to find out who Bernhard would like to play with.
Now, Mr. Langer, we always ask this of our guests. Same question. If you could have three players to round out your dream foursome, whether they're alive or not, who would those three be and where would you play that round?
I would probably choose my two sons and Ben Hogan, because I never had a chance to play with Ben and never saw him swing a club, really, even though he was still alive when I came along and he was obviously a Masters winner as well, but never had the opportunity, so that would be fun. And where would I play it? Probably at Pebble Beach. I just love the scenery there. It's gorgeous.
And one final question for me, and it's an obvious question that so many people have, and that is, how have you played so well for so long on the PGA Tour Champions? I'm wondering if you would just maybe a quick snapshot of what's your daily regimen like in terms of diet, exercise, what you stay away from, whether you're playing or not?
Well, my diet is the seafood diet. So whenever I see food, I eat it. I'm afraid to say I'm not on a diet. I love sugar. I crave sugar, and I eat way too much of it. So I shouldn't even say this, but I eat anything. Obviously, I eat salads and vegetables and a lot of fish and not too much red meat. But I don't really watch what I eat. But I do exercise. And I often say I exercise because I want to eat. So I do a lot of stretching. I do exercises. I enjoy life in general. I do other things. You know, people say, how can you go snow skiing? Isn't that too dangerous? I said, I love snow skiing. And, you know, if I hurt myself, I hurt myself. I'm not going to give up everything in life just to play golf. I've been blessed with a great wife and four wonderful kids. Now we have four grandkids. I had, you know, a wonderful coach in Willie Hoffman for 40 years. He passed away. And now I got another coach in Mike Richards who helps me here and there. And yeah, I've had, my brother was my manager for many years. Now Jim Lehman is helping out in that regard. So I've just had good people around me. I'm very loyal. I had good caddies in my life and just very blessed. But most of all, I think it's just God giving me a tremendous talent to play this game well. He's given me a sound mind. He's given me a great hand-eye coordination and a drive to compete and to do it even at this age of mine, you know, where I don't mind practicing. I've always enjoyed practicing. Some people hate going to the driving range, which we call Misery Hill, but I actually enjoy hitting balls and chipping and putting. So it's not a chore for me. It's something I enjoy doing, and I'm blessed to enjoy my job.
Bernard Langer, we very much look forward to seeing you back at the Insperity and then beyond in 2024. Thank you so much for joining us on Musings on Golf.
Thank you so much, both of you, and God bless you.
Introducing the epitome of golfing elegance and performance from William & Harry. Immerse yourself in style and unparalleled comfort as you step onto the green with William & Harry's unique durable deerskin and calfskin masterpiece. Unrivaled in its water-resistant design, the new and improved WH shoe, which is also available in private label, ensures that you stay focused on your swing, even in unpredictable weather conditions. So elevate your game to where luxury meets peak performance. Step into excellence. Step into innovation at williamandharry.com. Gosh, is Bernard Langer, has he ever come a long way from that kid who played with Jack Nicklaus at that little get together in Germany all those years ago to being at 66 and still seemingly as good as ever playing on the PGA Tour Champions. What a remarkable career and what a remarkable guy, Bob.
He really is. And I think that William and Harry golf shoes are in the same category as Bernhard Langer as a gentleman. You wear William and Harry, a couple of things are going to happen. They're going to surprise you. First, you're going to look better. You're going to get a lot of compliments. You're going to have better footing before your shots. And you're going to play better golf. Look better, play better. William and Harry, one of the key secrets.
Well, we certainly thank our friends at William and Harry and at Titleist for their support of Musings on Golf. We most definitely thank Bernhard Langer for joining us. Next week, well, Bob, we go from one Hall of Famer, Bernhard Langer, to another Hall of Famer, Lanny Watkins, the 1977 PGA champion, will be joining us, and you can bet, Robert, that Lanny will have a thing or two to say.
There's no question about that.
My good friend Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin, signing off. Musings on Golf.